listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
How did a Jew from Boston come to play such a role in bringing attention to indigenous California? This luminous book, and it really is a luminous book, The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin, The Damn Good Times of a Fiercely Independent Publisher, is a unique collaboration between the writer-editor Kim Bancroft and her subject, Malcolm Margolin. In it, you'll meet an irrepressible spirit, a man whose love for what he does and for the people he loves comes through on every page. You'll meet a storyteller and a man with a real genius for friendship and for building community. I met Malcolm Margolin almost by chance at the LA Times Festival of Books, seems decades ago, and I think it was. By chance, just stopped to talk to an interesting man at an interesting-looking booth, and within 6 months, we were collaborating on a series here at Central Library, which we called Eagle Feathers and Blue Jeans. And working with Malcolm was a delight and an education. We had many Native Californian artists and writers who participated in that program, and I learned so much. Malcolm has been honored as a national treasure by the National Endowment for the Humanities, and Heyday Books has been recognized as a vital cultural institution for all of California. I was born and grew up here in Los Angeles. I'm sure many of you did as well. And in my local elementary school, this was in the 50s, we learned about the history of our state by making flower and water maps, relief maps, and clay replicas of the Spanish missions. And we learned about Father Serra and the proud friars, the same ones who are pictured on that beautiful mural in the rotunda of the Central Library, with images of humble Indians kneeling at their feet. And it was never part of our school curriculum to understand that in California, there were over 500 different Indian tribes and over 100 different languages. And what's more, that this vibrant and complex culture still exists in our midst. Thanks to Heyday Books and thanks to Malcolm Margolin, News from Native California, a remarkable journal of California Indian writing, became, as Malcolm once put it, a place not to be extinct. And as one of its contributors, Daryl Babe Wilson, writes, it came out of a dream. So Malcolm Margolin is a dreamer, for sure, and the thing is, a lot of his dreams come to reality. His book, The Ohlone Way, has been recognized as a masterpiece, though when he wrote it, Malcolm was no expert on Native California culture. But as he himself has noted, lack of knowledge has never stopped me. Tonight, in addition to meeting Malcolm, we welcome as interlocutor Kim Bancroft, who's a gifted teacher, writer, and editor who edited Malcolm's memoir and several other Heyday titles, including Literary Industries, the autobiography of her great-great-grandfather, Hubert Howe Bancroft, founder of the library at UC Berkeley bearing his name. And we also welcome another very special member of the Heyday team, Vincent Medina, who has learned the language of his Muwekme Ohlone tribe primarily from field notes and wax cylinder recordings. Vincent is the assistant curator at Mission Dolores in San Francisco, and he's working to change the narrative of Indian history to focus on Native resistance and survival. So it's with great pleasure, it's a deep honor. Please welcome our guests.
Well, it is a wonderful pleasure to be here this evening. Did you want to say hello?
Yeah, there's all these people, all these old friends. Hello, how are you? How are you? Good to see you. Hey, Lisa. Hey, what a joy. Hey, they keep talking about this guy, Malcolm Margolin. He sounds really great. I'm looking forward to meeting him.
Well, in fact, he is very wonderful, as I learned in a long history of working with Heyday and especially in doing this book. So I think that we'll begin with an opportunity to provide a little bit of context for all of you about how we came to Heyday. And since we have the opportunity to, this evening with Vincent here with us, we'll end up focusing on Native California. But to begin with, let's address the question of how we came to Heyday. And we'll start with Malcolm, because you came to Heyday first.
I stumbled. I just stumbled into it. So back, you know, this is our 40th year, and we date the anniversary from the time a truck pulled out in front of my house and delivered 7,000 copies of a book, and we ended up sticking it under the kids' beds and around the walls, and that's how I date Heyday. But it actually began years before. It may have begun when I was about 6 years old and wrote the name Malcolm in some wet concrete and on the sidewalk and stood around waiting to be arrested. That I kept thinking that somebody was going to come and get me for this flagrant act of exposure. But back in 72, I think, I got fired from a job the one job that I ever had at the East Bay Regional Park District. And I had turned 30 a couple of years before, and I'd written a book for Houghton Mifflin. And then I had a kid that was sick and got better. And I had this year that Houghton Mifflin gave me $10,000 in 1972. And you could have bought a house at that point. And in fact, there was somebody that offered me a house for $13,000. And I remember calling them a capitalist pig. But I had this money and I had this time. And I took a year off. And I took a year off to just explore the East Bay, to explore the hills, to walk around, to understand how beautiful this world of ours was, to experience the flowers, to experience plants. Every day I would just get out there and I was free. And I was free of work. I was free of anybody. I was free of bad health. I was free of that. It was like a reprieve. That I'd just been released from jail, and I was out into this world. And I wrote this marvelously idiotic little love letter to the East Bay called The East Bay Out. And in 73, I started to typeset it and design it. And I put it together. It was part of that self-sufficiency movement of the 60s. And other people were doing better things like raising goats in Mendocino County. But goats and I would not have gotten along. So I wanted to be independent. I wanted to be free. And I typeset and I designed this book. And I think what got me into, and then I put it out into the world. And I think what got me into publishing was I conceived of myself as a writer. And and this is what I was going to do. I was going to write books. But the whole idea of typesetting them, the designing of them, the making them physical, the putting them out in the world was so much fun. I just couldn't believe how much fun it was. And I couldn't believe how I loved to have that within my power, that I didn't want to have to submit something to somebody else. I wanted to be free. I wanted to be independent. And this is what I was doing, was creating this independence. And I would no sooner today think of giving a book to a publisher than I would think of writing only the verbs and let somebody else write the nouns. I mean, there was something about that completion. There was something about bringing it out. A book isn't finished until it's read. You don't finish it when you finish writing it. You finish it when somebody's read it and you talk to them about it. And to be part of that whole process was a total joy. And then I did a few more books, and I operated out of the house. And then somewhere around 1980, there were too many kids and too many books, and the whole thing was just got ridiculous. And I couldn't get, and it was in the house. I couldn't get away from it. And I could never get into it either, because there were all these kids. And so then I took it out there, and I started to publish other people's books. And that's how I got into Heyday.
Wonderful. That's the beginning of Heyday. And I'll jump in now because I came in sort of towards the middle of Heyday in the, I guess, probably the mid-1990s. I was teaching English classes at Merritt College, and I had a student named Sadie Margolin in my class. And of course, I knew the last name. Who doesn't if you live in the East Bay and you've heard of Malcolm Margolin? And she came into class one day and said, "My father wants to see you." And I had been teaching high school before, so that sounded like trouble to me. And I said, if you've got a problem with your teacher, you're in college now, so you need to talk to me about it. And she said, no, he wants to give you a job. And apparently she had taken home some of these papers that I was editing so voluminously, and I went in to talk to Malcolm about a job editing, and he gave me a wonderful assignment, which was a memoir of the Pitt River Indian man, Darrell Wilson, which was his book about growing up in near under the shadow of Mount Shasta, the morning the sun went down. So I did a little bit of editing, and then I had to continue on my way as a teacher. But when I finally decided to leave teaching behind, I came back and asked Malcolm about other editing work. And at the same time, I had decided that I really wanted to learn a little bit more about my family history, and that led me into researching what was in the Bancroft Library that I had ignored for so long. And I found an 800-page autobiography of my great-great-grandfather, Hubert Howe Bancroft. And I decided to edit that and got it down to a 250 pages that are actually readable. I have my brother here, Bradford Bancroft, and sister-in-law, Phyllis. And I was trying to get the other brothers and father interested in reading the 800 pages, and we had a blog, a family blog, and after 100 pages, they said, "You go, Kim, you can do it." And so when I mentioned to Malcolm that I had done this book, he was very interested in publishing yet another legacy piece from California's history and literature. So that was a wonderful re-entry into heyday. And after that, I said, "So Malcolm, when are you going to write your memoir?" And he said, "I don't have time to write my memoir. I'm busy getting other people to get their books out." And so I, perhaps like my great-great-grandfather, who wanted to sit down and take dictations from the early settlers, I asked Malcolm if I could start recording his stories, and thus you have the heyday of Malcolm Margolin. So that's been it's been a wonderful journey coming back and working with him. And he insisted this is not going to be a book about me. It's going to be a book about heyday. They're pretty intertwined, but indeed it has been a wonderful experience learning about the people who work at heyday, the people who write for heyday, his kids, his friends. And that included Vincent Medina, who was one of the last people who had been hired when I started on this project. So I got to interview Vincent. So now I turn it over to you. How did you come to heyday?
Well, heyday has always been in the background of my life. I'm 27, and when News for Native California when its first year of being was the same year that I was born. So I can always remember how old the magazine is because it's as old as I am. But the magazine, like I said, it's been in the background of my life. It's been on my family's coffee tables. It's been in a special place in my family. And The Ohlone Way, which is the second book that you published, right? That's always been something that's very special to me. And in the Bay Area, which is, I'm Ohlone, we're the native people of San Francisco. And in that big place that we call the San Francisco today, that we call the Bay Area, it can often be very lonely if you're a native person, because there's not a whole lot of tangibles of our existence, that place that we've been living in for thousands of years. And it felt wonderful to be able to go into News from Native California and pick up the Ohlone Way and see it in bookstores and see it on coffee tables and be able to have this glimpse into what I see in my reality at home, and something that was so authentic and based on truth and honesty. And I have a lot of respect for that. And I started working at heyday about a year and a half ago, and I wasn't even sure how this came to be, but I came into the office and Malcolm said, "Oh, you're finally here. I'll get you your desk." So I came in and I had no idea.
That's a hiring process.
I had no idea what my position would be, and I had no idea what exactly I'd be doing. But one of the great things about Malcolm is he takes a lot of chances and he takes a lot of risks in people. And he, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he said before that something that is so wonderful, that the jobs at Heyday are formed around people. People form the jobs. So our personalities and what we're good at make our position. And he's been able to give me a place where I can have this wonderful experience where I can do what I'm best at, and I'm grateful for that. So I've been working at Heyday for about a year and a half, and I've taken somewhat of a front seat to this magazine that's been so important in my life, where I've been able to write articles and see the backgrounds of publishing and be able to. I'm working on a book on Native games right now, and I'm grateful. So it's been a year and a half of fun times.
Very good. Well, there are
So I was so stunned that somebody had actually read those 800 pages. This was the first person I'd ever met that had read this book, and it was utterly remarkable. It was utterly remarkable.
Well, thank you. It was wonderful also to see the synchronicity of me working on a book about Heyday, and then to actually have this beautiful book come out that included illustrations from the Bancroft Library. And as so many people who were writers for Heyday and working at Heyday were commenting about the beautiful books that Heyday comes out with, it was an honor to get to have it published through Heyday. So that brings me to a question. There are so many things that one can talk about Heyday, the work that they do in many different communities, the kind of publishing, the kind of business they are, the hiring practices that are so unique. But we do want to focus this evening on Native California. And the two pillars that really started Heyday were this book that was the natural history, East Bay Out, and The Ohlone Way. And they continue to be strengths of Heyday's publishing. So maybe let's focus a little bit on the way that The Ohlone Way and News from Native California came to be, and the other publications, your connections to Native California, if you could speak about that, the deep hanging out that you talk about in this book that you were able to do in California's rancherias and reservations and with friends that you met.
Yeah, hey, let me talk for a second about the natural history part of it all, because the natural history part of it all is what got me into all of this. And we're working, we have a wonderful project with Maya Lin that we're working on, which is the deep history of California. And it's the history of the animals of the Pleistocene, the mammoths, the dire wolves. And this was only about 12 or 15,000 years ago when people first arrived. The herds of bison that were here, the camels, the llamas, the giant sloths, the short-nosed bear, the saber-toothed tiger, the American lion, all this magnificent animal life that was here, and the coming of people and the settling of people throughout California, and the changes of wildlife, and the coming of the Europeans, and when they came, the herds of pronghorn antelope and the elk and the salmon up in the rivers of Northern California, and the mountain sheep in the desert, and the coming of people of Europeans, and the displacement of Indians, and the deterioration of environment, and the setting aside of natural land. And now in the Bay Area, tule elk have been reintroduced, elephant seals are up there, a condor has been sighted in San Mateo County, peregrine falcons are back, bald eagles are back, porpoises are back in the bay. And there's this amazing thing that we're going through of gain and loss. And what is at the basis of it is change. And this is, and it's fundamental to my way of thinking that we live in a world of change. And that what we have to preserve in the environment, whether it's a native environment or whether it's a natural environment, what we've got to preserve is not the individual thing itself, but we've got to preserve the underlying fecundity, the underlying sense of beauty, the underlying abundance of what's here, and the capacity of us to change and the world to change. I got into this California Indian stuff because I had written a book. I'd written the East Bay Out, and I'd published it, and I needed another book to write, and I was a hippie, and I belonged to the hippie tribe, and I was a pretty good hippie. And I knew, because I was a hippie, I thought I knew something about Indians, because we had posters of black elk, because we had all read Carlos Castaneda, who I got to meet in later years, and this guy was a trip. I mean, Carlos Castaneda was absolutely he was a fascist. He was the weirdest guy I ever met. And there was Alcatraz Island, and there were all these marvelous things about Indians. And as a hippie, I clearly knew all that you had to know about Indians. So I set aside for 3 months, I was going to write a book on Indians of the Bay Area, and I would publish it the way I did the East Bay Out. And I got into this thing, and what I found that I knew was a whole bunch of cliches about how Indians led a simple life, how they ate acorns, how they didn't affect the land, how they lived in peace. And these were all these cliches. And then I began to read the literature, the anthropological literature. And this was even weirder than the cliches. There was stuff in there about, in 1792, George Vancouver came to the Bay Area, and he left a description of an Ohlone house. And it was a tule house. It was dome-shaped. It was 6 feet in diameter. And he went on. And this was quoted again and again and again. It was quoted without anybody ever thinking about it. How does a family live in a house 6 feet in diameter? I mean, what's this all about? That nobody had imagined this world. They were just taking data and they were passing it along. And I began to imagine it, and I began to think about it, and I began to work it out, and I began to use literary technique to get into this sort of thing. And at one point, I discovered to my absolute shock that there were Indians still around. This was a revelation. And there were Ohlone Indians. I thought they were extinct. I thought this was going to be a library piece of work. But there were these Ohlone Indians still around, and somebody suggested that I see a guy named Phil Galvin. And Phil Galvin was down in Fremont, and he was your cousin?
My cousin, yes.
Hey, can you describe Phil? Phil was a trip.
Phil came from this generation, this older generation of Ohlones who saw in the 1920s, he was born in the 1920s, but he grew up in this generation that saw the reality of cultural loss. He saw in his lifetime the language stop being spoken, and he saw in his lifetime the roundhouses in our family that were burned down. He saw the political recognition and these issues of sovereignty. He saw sacred sites being trampled on, and he really saw the Bay Area get built up into this urban place, and that's our homeland. But the thing that is so wonderful and so magical, I could say, about Phil is that he had this deep set humor and this love for family and place that transcended all of that change around him that was happening. And there was this wisdom that he had. He had this quiet air of wisdom that his presence would dictate a situation. His presence would dictate how people in our family would vote for something. He was part of this generation that in the 1960s, when nobody knew Indians existed, fought Caltrans to divert bulldozers going through and destroying our family cemetery. And the cemetery, it's called the Ohlone Cemetery. It's in Fremont, close to one of the missions, Mission San Jose. And his family, his mother, my grandfather, they came together and they rallied to protect that place. And one of the reactions that many people had was, why do you care so much about it? It's ancient history. And his mother said, she stood up in front of Fremont City Hall and she said, my mother is buried there. So even though we've been using this place for thousands of years, we still use it. And last year, Phil passed. He sure was buried at that place that he cared so much about. And one of the wonderful things about Phil that will always stay in my mind is he, like I said, with language, and I'll talk more about language later, but he grew up, and his first few years of the language before it stopped being spoken. And I don't like to say before it was extinct or anything like that, because I prefer to say it went to sleep, because we have enough documentation of it to bring it back, and that's what we're doing. But in those first few years of his life, he heard Xochitl spoken in Pleasanton and in the East Bay. And it stopped being spoken for about 70 years. And in the last few years of his life, he heard Chochenyo come back again and be spoken again as an active language, be spoken with meaning and beauty and importance. And I'll never forget what he said. It was a couple of months before he passed away. He came up to me after I was giving a bit of a speech in Chochenyo, and he whispered in my ear, which is what he would often do. He said, "I'm glad I live long enough to see it spoken a second time." And the beauty that's connected to that is that his generation saw that cultural loss, but they also saw this resurrection and the revitalization of these things that, you know, maybe we didn't think would come back. But because of that generation and that strength that Phil had, and my grandfather, my great-grandmother, and so on, we are today able to relearn and to keep that alive because of those strong people. So that's who Malcolm is talking about when he says Phil Galvin. It's definitely somebody who I could only hope I could live in the shadow of. It's an honor.
Hey, so listen, I pretend to be an intellectual, I pretend to be a writer, I pretend to be a publisher. I'm nothing but an emotion junkie. And you meet somebody like Phil and you just stop cold in your tracks and you pay tribute to this man. At the time that I met Phil, what I was looking for was that old way of life. And he knew a lot about it, but so much had been lost. He didn't himself speak the language. He'd preserved a lot of the information, and I got some of that from him. But I was aware of this cultural loss. What I was also aware of was I was in the presence of a person who was simply great. I was in the presence of somebody that was so capacious, that had taken all of that suffering, was principled, was a magnificent human being. And it got me from this concentration on the past to look around at who was there in the present. And throughout California, there were some people around at that point. The Ohlone had been taken into the missions in the early, around the 1770s, 1780s, 1790s, early 19th century. There were people around that hadn't been touched until the gold rush. And there were still, and when I got into this stuff in the mid-70s, there were people around who had been raised by aunts and uncles and grandparents, that they'd been raised by a generation that remembered that old California before the coming of Europeans. And there were people around that were so rooted. There was a humor to them. There was a sadness. All these remnants of these shattered little nations throughout California. There was a defeat. There was a ferocity. There was a sense of the magic of the world. There was the sense of the witchcraft that made the world run, the poisonings and stuff, the stuff that's being lost today as people are becoming overly polite. There was something in that world of theirs that was, there was a nobility, there was a kindness, there was a familial sense, there was a sense of humility, that the world is bigger than our capacity to understand it. And I started to meet people like this, Vivian Hailstone and David Risling and Wallace Burroughs and Mabel McKay and Elsie Allen and Laura Somersall. I knew Laura when she was 100 years old. And there were these people that were utterly magnificent. And this is what got me into this Indian publishing stuff. And it was the people that drew me in. I began news after the Ohlone Way. I wrote a book called The Way We Lived. I wanted to get Indian voices in there. I was sick of my own voice. I wanted to get Indian voices in there. So I wrote these stories and reminiscences and stuff that I had collected from Indian world. And then I started News from Native California, and I started it to document that older generation that was fading away. People like Edna Guerrero, people. This marvelous generation that I sensed was at the firing line and they were disappearing. I came to write a eulogy. What I didn't understand was that we'd be present at a rebirth.
Mm. So Malcolm, maybe let me ask you to read from a section of the chapter where you talk about your work in Native California and going to a roundhouse in Ione, and then, and that captures a part of the past that continues to be rebuilt. And then ask Vincent to touch on what it means to be Native in this world today.
This is the passage that
Laura requested, yes.
That Louise requested.
Let me hold this for you. Okay.
Adjustments. So one of the things that I love best is I go out to these Indian reservations and I wander around with people and they show me their land and I hear their stories. And this was at Ayon, which is in the foothills of the Sierra. And maybe I'll talk later on if we have time about the old Ayon roundhouse. And so we went out to... The last time I was up at Ayon, my good friend Brian Bibby and Glenn Villa's grandson Connor asked, "Do you want to take a ride over to Ayon? We'll show you around." So we went to Ayon. They showed me where the roundhouse used to be, where the cemetery was, and the gate Connor had built with his father. They showed me the baby smashing rock where the pioneers had smashed babies' heads. They showed me where the Yerba Buena plant grows strongest and the footprints where the great animals had walked the world. They showed me the viewpoint where you could see Mount Diablo across the whole Central Valley. They showed me all these different things. It was a wonderful naming of things, senseless in a way. No plot to it, just the preservation of fact, the accumulation of memory, this investment in the land, so fragmented, so deeply felt. Such sadness and such beauty.
So now let me ask Vincent, as Malcolm has been capturing the world that was and continuing to travel in the world that is, what does it mean for you to be Ohlone today, and how do you try to project that messages about that, share it with the world, and take in messages as well from a whole variety of Native folks?
As I touched upon when I first started talking, is the issue comes up of visibility. And this whole notion that many people have outside of our community, that we're extinct, that we don't exist anymore. And one of the most common responses that I get when I tell people, actually, we do exist, is, "Well, you don't look like you're an Indian. Where's your feathers at?" You know, I always get that. And what people are often expecting are these stereotypes of what they see in the mainstream media, of what they might see on TV and in the newspapers or in old books or old pictures. And what I try to talk about as much as I can is to talk about how Indian people, we're contemporary people. We're part of the modern world. We're part of 2014. And if somebody was to meet me, I'm like any other 27-year-old, and I love my car, I love my iPad, I love my iPhone, and I love Facebook. I'm sure Malcolm knows that. But one of the things that I think is important as we talk about this is that just because we know who we are as people, just because we know that we're modern people, doesn't mean that we don't care about the past. And with any living culture, there's a great deal that's known about the past, but there's also a great deal about the future and about hope and what the future can bring. And I think that one thing that I try to do is to blend those two worlds together as much as I can, is blending this old world and this new world and things that are modern and things that are ancient. And the two aren't incompatible because we're living people, we're breathing people, and that's part of our tradition, is historically we've adapted to changes. And I think of my family who came into the missions. My relatives, they were at Mission Dolores back in the 1700s. They were at Mission San Jose back in the 1800s. And they came from villages before the Spanish came here. They came from villages that are ancient and old and are rooted in the Bay Area for thousands of years. And they came at a time when the world was changing. But instead of giving their world up, they found ways to adapt this world that was being imposed on them with this world that they cared about and they loved about and that we still love about even today. So when I think about modern times and I think about the old times, I think that adaptation is something that's part of our tradition. And I don't think that that those two are incompatible. So one thing that I try to do is I'm big on social media. I'm big on using technology. And I try to use a blog that I created named Being Aloney in the 21st Century, which is meant to teach people and to share my stories, to share things that are contemporary, that are ancient, that are old, things that are sometimes unique experiences that we as Aloney face that maybe others might not face, and to be able to share those things in meaningful ways. I work a lot with language, and I try to share language and record language on social media. And I don't think of that as being a departure from those old ways. Our relatives in the 1920s, they used wax cylinder recordings to record their language, and now we use our iPhones, you know? So there's not much of a difference there. It's just the world changes, but the technology... the technology changes, but the world stays the same. And so this is what I try... I guess that's how I reconcile the two.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, another question I have for both of you is what we can learn from Native California. What can we take now into the future that all of us, whatever our cultural background is, what are some important things that we should be holding in our hearts and our minds, taking into the future from Native California?
With Native California, I think that Malcolm said this very eloquently, and it's something that I feel deeply, is that when the world learns about Native California, they learn about the oldest stories of this land, they hear the oldest languages of this land, they learn about things that benefit everybody, not just the Indian world, but they benefit everybody. These stories that we have there in our communities, they're so beautiful, and they move people, and they're full of drama, they're full of absolute beauty. And it's a gift for everybody to be able to learn these things. When we talk about the struggles that our people have gone through and are still going through even today, these are human struggles that I feel many people can relate to. We're talking about things like loss, you know, heartbreak, tragedy, but out of those ashes and that darkness comes something that's just as beautiful, and that's survival and power. And also the thing is that when we learn about California, I believe that we're able to learn about a unique worldview that's endemic to this place that we all love. And we were talking over dinner about how in California, because it's such a diverse place, you know, we're talking hundreds of different tribes, over 120 different languages spoken. This place that's of diversity and of beauty and of just so much difference. But how, even in this place that we care so much about, how there could be different worldviews and different perspectives. And for an example, in my family, the world was created on top of Mount Diablo. If you go 50 miles to the north, the world was created on another peak. And somehow people found a way, even if they had different centers of the world and different languages and different basketry patterns and different songs and different dances and all these differences, some people found a way to coexist with relative peace and relative meaning and were able to forge meaningful relationships. And I think that this is something that we could all learn from, especially with the tragedies that we see happening in the world today. In 2014, we can learn about this beauty and this meaning and this coexistence that is something that I don't think a lot of people fully can comprehend right now.
So among all of the terrible things that have happened to California Indians, getting stuck in the fourth grade curriculum was one of the worst. That you end up having silly questions that are asked, elementary questions, as if these were a simple people, and we ask how they collected food and how they made houses. I think we ought to raise the bar. There are bigger things that we can learn from them. We can learn how to... those stories that Vincent was talking about, these were not so much stories that captured knowledge, they captured wonderment. Those stories that we don't understand about how hummingbird married buckeye tree and gave birth to grizzly bear and rescued the sun. These things that are completely incomprehensible and arcane, they're laying meaning, they're laying something over this land, they're laying a sense of wonderment and relationship over it all. And there's that marvelous sense that of the humility of the human enterprise. There's something in that there's something about how do you create a society in which there's little hierarchy, how you create a society in which there's widespread artistic achievement, how you create a society in which there's a sense of rootedness and a sense of belonging. What Vincent was talking about, people getting along together, that there was up in the northern part of California, you have the Hoopa have their center of the world at Takamildig, the Kuruk have their center of the world at Katamin, the Yurok have their center of the world at Kinnek. They dance at each other's centers. There's no question about which is the true center of the world. They say that it was there, we say it was here. In Europe, you would have had a religious warfare that would have, you would have had 3 million people killed to find the true center of the world. The California Indian religion was not packed for conversion. It was still Muslim, Judaism, Christianity. These major religions of the world have been packed into ideologies. They've been packed into dogma. What those religions are, they're packed into experience. They're packed into place. They're packed into a direct emotional relationship. And when you're around these old characters, when you're walking with them on their land, when they walk past a big rock, and that big rock in a previous life had been a person, had been a divinity, there's a kind of quiet, there's a respect that you have for that rock. There's a sense of the world in which everything is alive in it, everything has integrity in it. And there's a sense of the world speaking to you. I remember several years ago being up on the Klamath River with this guy, Chuck Donahue. And Chuck Donahue was he made dugout canoes. And when you're a publisher and people tell you that you're into something that is outdated, I'd give Chuck a ring to find out how the dugout canoe business was going. And he says, it's a little bit slow these days. And I say, I know what you mean. So I was out there with Chuck, and we were walking around, and we hear the mourning dove coo. And he says to me, do you know the story of mourning dove? And the Yurok word for mourning dove is orui. And I said, I've heard the story, but I'd love to hear you tell it to me, Chuck. So Chuck tells me the story of mourning dove, about how in the world before this, when all animals were people, mourning dove was a famous gambler, and he was playing Indian, they call them Indian cards, which is a kind of dice game with counters. And he was sitting there, and he was on a winning streak. He was winning stuff. He was winning all these marvelous Indian treasures. He was winning red woodpecker scalp. He was winning black obsidian. He was winning albino deer skin. He was surrounded by all this wealth. And somebody comes to him and says, Orui, your grandfather is dying. You have to come to his deathbed. And Orui says, I'll be there in a few minutes. I'm on a winning streak. So he continues to play. The grandfather dies. And when the great transformation happened, Mourning Dove was transferred. The person Mourning Dove was transferred into the bird. And you can still see around his neck the treasures that it had won. And I thought for a while that what this was talking about was how you have to pay attention to mourning. What it talks about is that you have duties as a human being. And you lived in a world that with its truths of the world were scattered in stories. The world was constantly speaking to you. The world was constantly lecturing to you. It was a vibrant, living world. And it was a world in which... Hey, we'll talk about language later on. We may not get to it.
We may. Well, let me jump in there about this idea about how we learn from each other's cultures, because I had a very important lesson in the process of editing Hubert Howe Bancroft's book. He published his book in 1890 and came from a time when Native Americans had gone through a terrible near annihilation in California, and there were places in his autobiography where he talked about how much he was disgusted by the Indian butchers whose stories he had taken down, and how important many of the Native peoples are to California history and their religions and the complex societies. But there are also places where he talked about them being savages, and he did not respect necessarily all of the civilizations that he encountered as a Victorian gentleman. And it was interesting for me in the process of editing that book to kind of figure out, well, what do I want to keep in and what do I want to hide and what makes me ashamed and what am I proud of? And Vincent and I had a really wonderful conversation about this, about how for many of us as white people coming down from perhaps all different kinds of backgrounds, that it's important to acknowledge that past and to not be afraid to be honest about what's happened in the past and to embrace the fact that we may have a very strong social justice agenda for ourselves and for the future, and they aren't incompatible. And so I think that's been, for me, especially as a teacher working in very multicultural communities and working on this book, getting to talk to Native people or, you know, African Americans who are part of the Heyday Writers Club and people who come from many, many cultures. Heyday has been all about trying to give them voices, and it's important for us who represent that, are part of that community, to be able to carry forth that humility and understand that is our human project. Our duty as a human being is to be able to communicate and not be afraid to speak the truth.
Yeah, hey, listen, that guilt stinks. There's something, if it keeps you away from things, if it freezes you up, it's worthless. I mean, we have to just get on with this business of breaking down the walls and get on to listening to other people as deeply and compassionately as we can, and get out there and have some fun and enjoy this world. Mm-hmm. And I would like to absolve you of the guilt of your grandfather.
Thank you. Well, I think it's actually Vincent who's supposed to absolve me.
Oh, you're absolved.
Thank you. Okay. See, it's that
you're all absolved.
So let us finish before we open up for questions and answers to go back to that question of language, because one of the wonderful projects of Heyday that you've been involved in is language revitalization going back 25 years or more, and that Vincent has been a beneficiary of and a wonderful carrier of that particular torch. So speak about the role of language in particular and what how Heyday has been participating in language revitalization, if you would.
Yeah, hey, so there's all these marvelous Indian languages, and each of them has their own musicality, their own tonality, their own way of seeing things, their own structures. But let me first start talking about English and the way it's spoken in this dominant culture of ours. Over the last 40 years of publishing, I've watched the language take on, is become the language of salesmanship, that everybody is selling everybody something. We're in there with something that everybody's got a shtick. Everybody's pushing something on. It's an aggressive language. And even as I'm talking this language now, I'm sensing a kind of aggression to it. I'm sensing a kind of pushiness to it all. I'm making a point. You get into those old Indians out in the foothills, you'll go up, and there'll be something. It's more nuanced. It's more gentle. It's sort of like you go up there and you say something like, "Who made the world?" And somebody will say, "Oh, I don't know. I think maybe it was Coyote. I don't know who made the world." And there was something about that tone. I love people's kitchen voices. I love people's voices when they're mulling things over, when you get to their real voice, when you get to the things that are tangential to our way of seeing things, when we're not making a point, when we're not lecturing, when we're not selling. Those Indian languages are just absolute marvels. So we ended up helping to set up some language apprentice programs with Leanne Hinton. And one of the programs that we set up, you never would have met Georgiana Trull, the Yorok woman. I think she died before you came on the scene, which is too bad. She was Yurok from the Klamath River, and she was not just Yurok, she was Talth Yurok, aristocratic Yurok. She came from Rekwa, from the good family. She came from the house of Sha'ah, and this was the aristocratic house in there. And she spoke, at the time, Yurok was down to about 18 speakers, but she was the last one that spoke Talth, that spoke the aristocratic Yurok. And this was like the king's English. And we'd had to find an apprentice for her, but it had to be an apprentice from a good family because she wouldn't take an apprentice from a bad from a lower class family. So this became a real challenge. And we finally found this woman, Carol Lewis. At that time, she was Carol Korb. We found Carol Lewis, and Carol Lewis came from a very good family, and we got them together, and we paid them some money to stay together for several months while she learned Talth Yurok. And after a few months, I visit Carol, and I say, "How's it going?" And she says, "This is the most humiliating and terrible experience of my life." I say, "What's happening?" She says, "I'm still learning how to count." So I said, "What do you mean you're still learning how to count?" There are 21 different ways of counting in Yurok, depending upon what's being counted. So like three cups is not the same as three people, is not the same as three myths, is not the same as three chairs. And old Georgina would sit there and say, "How do you say three books?" And she'd say this, and Georgina would go, "No, oh no, you can't say it that way. Bad things will happen." These languages are just marvelous. The Yurok language had, along the Klamath River, there were inflections where you had to tell people as you were talking to them, as I am talking to you today, I would have to, that verb talking would have to have as an inflectional whether I'm talking to you upstream from the Klamath River or downstream from the Klamath River, upslope or downslope. And it had to, and you had to place yourself in terms of that river, and the river was, these people had lived along that river for so many years that the river flowed through their language. It, that they were connected. The language was connected directly to the land. This business of everything having its own way of counting. You can't have a mathematical system based on this. You couldn't do the marvelous things that our engineers and technocrats have done. But what you have is the individual uniqueness of everything in that world. Everything has its dignity. Everything has its wonderful uniqueness.
Well, that would be a good point to turn over to Vincent. So,
yeah, do you know anything about language?
Yeah.
Well, I grew up, and it is entirely honest to say, I didn't grow up speaking my family's language, which is Chochenyo. Chochenyo, it's one of the Ohlone languages from the East Bay of San Francisco. And when I was growing up, I always wanted to know, similar to what Malcolm was saying, what gossip would sound like in the language. Because I would look at my aunties and my cousins, and I would see the way that when they would talk back and forth to one another, and they were in the privacy of their homes, and they were doing something where their minds would just wander, and they would talk about other people, how their bodies would just change, and their voices would lower, and how they just became just different people altogether when they were gossiping. Mm-hmm. So I always wondered, what would gossip sound like in Chochenyo? What would it sound like just if people were having daily conversations? Not lengthy speeches, or not, you know, welcoming proclamations, or not anything like that, but just daily conversation, what it would sound like. And I knew that my father didn't speak it, that my grandfather didn't speak it, that all these people in my family, they were affected by these waves of colonization and of suppression, and they didn't speak the language when I was a kid. And what I started to do was I started to work with this treasure trove of information called the John Harrington Notes. And there was this eccentric linguist who was focusing on languages here in California back in the 1920s, the 1930s. And he saw the reality that California Indian languages all throughout the state were threatened, that unless they were recorded, that they could stop being spoken altogether, that these treasure troves of information could be lost. And he recorded some people in my my family's village that they lived in after the missions, a place called Alisal, which is today what we call Pleasanton. And at that time, there were just two people who spoke Chochenyo back in the 1930s, just two. They were both in their 70s. One of them was named Jose Guzman, and the other was named Angela de los Colos. And they recorded this language, and it must have been an awfully lonely place, just to be the last two people of a language that's been spoken for thousands of years, and to know that if they died and the language wasn't recorded, then with them, the language died as well. But these people, these are the heroes in this situation, is they took that reality and they made it into something, and they weren't going out without a fight. So they took all that language that they cared about, and they sat down with this linguist, late 1920s, early 1930s, and they recorded as much as they could. And we're talking not just simple word lists, but these are in-depth recordings where they're going back and telling of a time when the coyote left his footprints in the world, and songs were sung about Mount Diablo, and clamshell beads were thrown into the bay at a certain point to appease spirits that could hurt human beings, and family gossip and lore and the roundhouses and why they're important to us. They told stories of a time when there were these bodies of stone that roamed in the underworld, and they were defeated, and after that, death came to be. Of stories when the world was flooded, all but the peak of Mount Diablo. And these stories are ancient, and they recorded them with this immediacy as if they happened yesterday. They recorded their songs on these wax cylinder recordings, where they sang songs about dusting off pain and dusting off sorrows and shaking off all of that suffering and just moving forward. They sung songs about Mission Peak, like I said, where they would welcome the mountain into the world. And I go back today and I hear these voices and I read those notes, and through that we're able to relearn and to hear those people and to connect with this language and bring it back, not just in ways of learning simple words, but of bringing it back in meaningful ways where we can learn tenses and we can learn grammatical structures and we can learn this intensity of what they saw. And it's beautiful. So through this, I've been able to work with my family, and we're starting to see measurable success where children are speaking it. My little brother, I'm so proud of him. He's 11 years old, and he led a language class about 2 weeks ago. Children are speaking it. The elders are hearing it again. And when we speak this language again, I feel like the world around us hears it as well. It resonates with this being and intensity. And it must make the world feel good to hear this language come back, especially in our homeland in the Bay Area, where it must have been very lonely for not hearing it for so long. And to hear it come back in meaningful ways, it's the thing that I feel that I'm most proud of in my life, if I could say it, that there's one thing. Thank you.
That is a wonderful contribution. So I think this is a good time for us to open up for a few minutes of questions, if any of you have questions. And there will be a few people traveling around with microphones to take questions if you have any. Just want to thank Louise again for bringing us here. You have an amazing library here. We got a tour of it. It's just gorgeous. So I hope you all treasure it.
Yes, first I would like to thank you so much for coming down and visiting us here. I mean, to have such august persons. And I bought your book, and I had to choose. And I called it the Olone Way. And I was thinking in terms of, oh, alone, you know. My question is, I began reading when I was waiting, and you said that Olone was fabricated, the nomenclature, the name. And what I'm wondering is, wasn't there anybody who would ask, what do you call yourselves? I mean, just asking.
Maybe a question to answer the origins of the name and the various ways of understanding it.
I'm not done.
The divisions of people were just so arcane and so fluid that these names, that we have to put names on things. The original people didn't have to put names on things quite as much. There was a wonderful guy that came into California in the 1870s, Powers, and he was up in the Sacramento Valley, and he meets these people, and he says, who are you? What do you call yourself? And they said, we're Maidu. So he says, okay, the Maidu, that's the tribe of these people. In 1902, there was a linguist from Harvard came over, and he came to these people, and he found out that Maidu meant people. It wasn't a tribe, it meant people. So he said they were people. In 1950s, my wonderful friend Bill Shipley went up there. He discovered that Maidu also meant animals. What they were saying was, we're beings. They were defining themselves in this broad way. There were people all over. There were people that came from villages. I think one of the things we can learn about California Indians is from this world is that there's no one way of being human. There were people that lived in villages of 100. There were people that lived in small clans. There were different political ways. There were different ways of eating. There were different ways of hunting. There were different social mechanisms. Along came the anthropologists, and they had to find names for these people. And they originally found all these related languages in the Bay Area and called them Costanoans, coastal people. Mm-hmm. In later years, the coastal people decided that they didn't want this ungainly name that anthropologists had given them. So some of them called themselves Ohlone, and some of them didn't call themselves Ohlone. And
Vincent, you want to join in on that?
You don't have to.
Well, what Malcolm's talking about with this huge geographic, linguistic, you know, tribal identities that are in the Bay Area is that, for an example, here in the East Bay is an area that goes down about 40 miles, the interior of the East Bay. Within that interior, people call themselves, at the time in the 1930s, three different distinct groups, but they're all based on a common linguistic group. So the people from up north, they would call themselves Poya, and then there's the term Nishanka, and then there's another term where some people would identify with the term Wekma, which means the people. So you have all these different terms, and what became needed was some sort of a thread that links people linguistically and culturally together from these far stretches. And the Ohlone area goes from San Francisco all the way down to about Monterey. And within that, there's huge difference. But within that, there's also shared similarities. And we needed something beside an anthropological term of the term Costanoan, which means coastal people, that's adopted from Spanish later into English. So Ohlone, it became something that we became comfortable with. And it's something that was adopted, but it's used now.
Okay, let's see if there's another question.
Anyone else?
There's one over here.
Well, first, I'm so grateful to be here, and particularly for all of us who love language and love books, it's really so great to hear you all talk. I'm particularly moved and resonating with the idea of the rebirth of language, the metaphor, as you say, about nature, that the language is coming back. I was going to make a comment somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but we know with humor there's always some truth that in today's society and with technology, many of our young people only know how to read and focus on 150 characters at a time. And so how difficult it is for you all who love the rich language to be in a group where we are often just putting less and less of the love of language into our communication. If you've got any thoughts on that.
Hey, so we had a Vincent ran an event over at our office in which we got people from around the state. It was a poetry slam in Indian languages. There was no translation, so nobody knew what the hell was. But poetry is incomprehensible anyway. So so it didn't really matter. But it was the most marvelous thing of people getting up with their languages and speaking in them, and speaking in them with range. When I first got into this, it was only old people that spoke the language, and it became kind of religious. You used it for opening prayers, you used it for ceremonies. Now you ended up having people that were, there was a group, a Nishinan group from around Auburn that had a rock band, and they were doing a rock opera on the gold rush in Nishinan language. Mm-hmm. There were people around there that were doing love songs in there. There were flirtations. It was sexy. Yeah.
It was sexy.
And to have this Indian language as sexy was a real improvement. There's piety to that world, there's somberness to that world, there's sadness to that world, but there's a vitality that just doesn't stop, that just comes back. And this language, there was a playful quality to it all. It was just that evening was a total joy.
It was one of the highlights I've had in the last year. We strung lights throughout the parking lot. We had a band that came. We had a California Indian feast. And the songs and the poetry and this intensity that people would have as they would step up to the microphone and have the courage to use their languages. I mean, we're talking, like Malcolm said, love songs, haikus in Hashimim. There was the song Smelly Cat in Hoopa. There was just a wonderful intensity and beauty. And Malcolm, as he was just saying, he ended the night by saying, in the 1980s, he saw these people who thought that they were the last of their speakers. And nowadays, we're encountering something that's quite the opposite, where there's this rebirth and this regeneration. And it's true. It is fun and playful, and it is sexy. You're right. It's very sexy. So there's nothing wrong with that. That's a living culture and a living language.
Okay, I think we have time for a couple more questions. There's one over there.
This has been a great discussion about the survival of language, but I was wondering about the survival of publishing and Heyday Books.
Survival of publishing.
And so if you could, especially Malcolm, if you could address that. I mean, 40 years is amazing. So was there a point where was there a watershed event in which you had to make a certain decision, or has it been like a steady commitment to something that sustained you through all this time?
So at one time, there were about 20 Yiddish newspapers in New York, and they all went bankrupt except for the Forvets. And somebody asked the publisher of the Forvets, how come everyone else went out of business and you're still here? And he said, it's because we were terrible bookkeepers. And they said, what do you mean? He says, they knew they were bankrupt. We never did. Hey, you just keep going. Angel City Press is sitting around here. I mean, you live on constant delusion. You live on the hope that the next book is going to bail you out. I ended up creating a nonprofit out of it because I've been in fundamentally nonprofit. So we have a friends organization that contributes. We get some grants. We put stuff out. I've been lucky. I think this thing runs. There's a river of beauty that flows through this place. And my job is to stand at that river of beauty with a ladle and pull things out and give them to the staff that makes the staff beautiful. And we put these books out that transform the world. And this is what keeps it going. It keeps it going by people that work without adequate wages and people that give to this enterprise. This is not a 9-to-5 job. That Lindsay, who runs our California Indian Publishing, said when you come to work at Heyday, she thought she was getting a job. What she discovered was she was getting citizenship in a small independent nation. and the world has been remarkably good to me. This is not a dog-eat-dog world. If this was a dog-eat-dog world, the three of us would have been eaten a long time ago.
All right, one more question, yes.
Oh, David.
Sometimes it seems to me like California Indians are the least tribal people in California. I have learned so much about all of California and its literature and its identity from Heyday books. I wonder how Heyday went from being a publisher about Native California and a publisher about the East Bay to come to define itself as a publisher of California from stem to stern. When did that happen and how?
Does anybody know? hey, listen, it happened. I just wandered around. I drifted aimlessly. I met people. This whole thing has been intensely personal. I think that it's reflected my acquaintances, it's reflected my love of things, it's reflected what I believe in, and it's getting beyond me right now. There are other people in there that are taking over and that are doing their own work, and there are books in there that other people are acquiring. But it had to do with how far my VW bus could get. That's what defines it, is how far my VW bus could get. California is a myth. California doesn't exist. In 1848, there was a constitutional convention, and a bunch of drunks put a line around some land and called this California. It doesn't reflect anything. It doesn't reflect topography. It doesn't reflect culture. It doesn't reflect climate. It was completely random and completely idiotic. And what Heyday is an act of the imagination that other people function in the real world. My job is the human imagination. And being active in the human imagination, to be active in a place that is imaginary, really works.
Malcolm and Vincent and Kim, I want to thank you for your beautiful work and for coming to gift us with it today. Please join me in thanking them, and they will be signing the book in the lobby afterwards.
Thank you all.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.